possessed, and without the ordinances thereof and the authority of the priesthood, the power of godliness is not manifest unto men in the flesh, for without this no man can see the face of God, even the Father, and live. What this scripture should say to you is that there's power in the priesthood, and that when the priesthood administer the ordinances properly, there is power in the church, that we can see the power of godliness manifest. But without these things, without the authority, without the ordinances, we will not see the manifestation of God's power. This is the problem in the apostasy, and this is what happened in that time, that great dark day when the authority was taken from the earth. I would like to look at some of this authority, because this is what makes our church unique. And there are scriptures who talk about it, and we could go to the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants, but I want to go to men in the scriptures whom all the world sees as prominent figures. There was a man, Abraham, and we think of him as Father Abraham because he was given all these blessings, and the Lord promised his seed would grow and would become the greatest, great nations would come out of Abraham. We forget sometimes that Abraham was a soldier. He had men that he trained to fight battles. And one day there was a time when these men had to get into action. Abraham's nephew Lot was kidnapped by some people and they were taken away. And Abraham got word of this, and he got his men that night, and they went about, they chased after these people, and they overcame them. The enemy didn't know they were there. And so while Abraham, he had his trained men, it says, and they encircled the camp, they went in some top secret covert mission, as if they were going to take out bin Laden. They came in, they pulled out Lot, and they brought him back home safe and sound. That's a great story of how powerful this Abraham was. But what did Abraham do as soon as he got home? He went home and he paid tithes and offerings. He didn't just go dig a hole in the earth and say, God, here's my money. He didn't just go to any Joe Blow off the street and say, here's 10% of what I own. He went to somebody who had priesthood authority. The high priest of the day was Melchizedek, and he went to him and he paid his tithes to him and put it in his hand. There was authority for Melchizedek to take that tithing money. Abraham is perhaps the greatest man ever known on the face of the earth to some. He paid tithes to somebody. It means he submitted himself to their authority. He recognized that they had some power over him, and that power came from God. So there was priesthood authority. Growing up, one of my favorite scriptures or stories was David and Goliath. And we can hear it on TV all the time if you ever choose to watch sports, which I wouldn't suggest, but you will. And you hear the misuse of this story on a regular basis. Look, and here is David versus Goliath. They're absolutely wrong. It's nothing like David and Goliath. Because you read the chapter of David and Goliath, and then you go back one chapter previous, and you find the story where Samuel went to Jesse's home. And he walked in, and we know the story. He called all his sons in because he was looking for a king. God told him to go find the new king. And all of David's brothers came in, and they were big, burly, strong, good-looking, kingly men. But yet, every single one of them, God said, that's not the one. Finally, Samuel, with his hands in the air, says, Lord, these are good guys. They can do the job. God says, you look on the outward appearance of a man, but I'm looking for his heart. And there's one that I know has a heart for me, and that's the one that I want to be king. David came in, and immediately Samuel knew that this is the man who will next lead the nation of Israel. He laid his hands on his head, anointed him king. The next chapter, which means after that happened, David went out to the battlefield. David had a mantle on his shoulders at that point. He wasn't just some naive young boy who walked out into the battlefield and decided, you know what, I got nothing to lose. He's not some teenager who's feeling invincible. He was a boy or a man who understood that I have the mantle of authority. I am the king of this nation, and I will lead them. David had authority to go out and step and take on Goliath. This is the power and authority that's been throughout the entire history of the world. Elijah, when he took the priests of Baal down to the water, when he challenged them, he had authority from God to be the prophet. Samuel had to take over for Eli, but Eli was still the prophet all the way until Samuel was trained. When Eli died, Samuel took over the prophet. There was a transfer of authority. We can follow this all the way through. If you read the book of John, you'll find priesthood authority mentioned in John. As Jesus talks to his apostles, a lot of us most of the world will think they'll show you a picture and you'll see 12 disciples. And everybody thinks those were all the people that were his disciples. Well, Jesus had thousands of disciples. So what made the 12 so different? Because they had authority. In one scripture, I believe it's, I think we'll get to it later, but I'm stomping on my own material here. He's gonna tell them, I called you and I chose you and I ordained you. He's talking to his 12. There was authority in that room of that Last Supper. There was authority whenever Jesus talked with those men. So there was authority all the way down through the church, and we can see that culminated even in the New Testament. That when Peter went to Cornelius, and the Holy Ghost fell on Cornelius and all the other people who were unbelievers. That's an indication of the authority. Priest Peter had the authority, but that also leads us into the next part of my sermon. What happened in the church Christ established? I think it's a pretty valid question, but did Christ actually establish a church? One of the movements today is that we need to stay in the middle of these things. Politically, whatever other idea you have, you kind of got to stay in the middle. We need to stay in this gray area because there is no such thing as black and white anymore. There's no clear-cut answer. There is no absolute truth. Ask somebody if they believe in absolute truth. Now just find somebody on the street and ask them. I've done it, and they said no. Of course, I knew the guy. I didn't just walk up and grab somebody. But I knew the fella. But he was on the street. But I asked him, do you believe in absolute truth? And he said no. But his belief was that the church, or that the Bible was written by monks, long, long time ago. And he gave me a date. I think it was 400 or 500, what we believed was BC or something like that. And my heart leapt when he said that, because that gave me an opportunity to witness, and I'll get into some of the witnessing opportunities you're going to have later on. Did Christ actually establish a church? The New Testament is full of the idea of one single church. Christ on many occasions said, I will, he talked about the church. Acts has several references. Romans has some. Corinthians talks about the church, the gifts that are to be had and used in the church. So many churches today refrain and even balk at the idea that there is one true church of Jesus Christ. They believe undoubtedly that in the Old Testament times there was one church, but when Christ came and died, however, this concept of his church is somehow lost or ignored. The reason there was, I'm not going to get into all the reasons they think this. I don't really know what goes on inside of the mind of other people. So I don't want to question their intentions. But Jesus on the coast asked his disciples or his apostles, whom do men say that I am? Some say John the Baptist. And others say Elias. Others say Jeremiah or one of the prophets. Peter said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, Jesus answered and said unto him, blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed this unto thee, but my Father who is in heaven. And I say unto thee, thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. And the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Jesus is clearly stating that he will build his church. His church, not a world of churches or a compilation of churches, but rather a church, one organization with Christ as the head. I will build my church. So when we ask ourselves this question, what happened to the church Christ established? What are we wondering? Is the church on the earth today? Has it always been on the earth? How do we know it is his true church? I've got many testimonies that I could share about this being the true church. I intended today to share some testimonies about the priesthood authority that I have felt the power of God in my life. When my oldest son was 4 months old, my wife had a dream that he would die. And that when he was 4 months old, he would no longer be with us. So you can imagine her horror when at 4 months old he got the flu. And if you've ever had a little baby who has the flu for the first time, it's a scary, scary thing. Their eyes close and they stay closed and they just kind of lay there and their body is burning up and you can feel them across the room, the heat that just radiates from their bodies. It's a scary thing. And then when you have a dream like she had when he was just born, knowing that, man, this could be a sign of things to come, you can imagine the horror and the lump in her throat on a daily basis while her son lay there in agony, not eating or even not doing anything. And so what we did was we went to the elders of the church. And the couple laid their hands on their head and they asked that he would be healed. We had been to the doctor that day and they said it's going to be 2 or 3 weeks. Kids had died all over the state of Missouri with this same kind of flu that they had. And so we were terribly afraid, but we put our trust in the Lord. The next morning, his fever broke. Now, I've told that testimony to some, and they've said, well, it could just be a coincidence. Well, I guess it could have been. But we fought with it for a week and a half, and it wasn't until we had the elders lay their hands on his head that he was healed. In my life, I've had 3 knee surgeries. And the only reason I have a bad knee is because I'm a knucklehead in the first place, and I do all kinds of dumb things that I shouldn't do. But one day I went and had a 3rd knee surgery, and I had to have the knee cleaned out, and they did it. And you know, it was the 3rd one. I'm not a kid anymore, and I'm realizing I need to slow down and stop doing the sports and the running and the jumping that I used to do. I just am not as strong as I used to be. And it was time to give that stuff up. And so I went, I said, this is the last knee surgery I'm going to have because I'm going to behave and never do anything dumb again. And I'm at work, and I'm on top of this 10-foot wall, and if my boss ever hears of this, I could lose my job, so nobody say anything. But I'm on top of a 10-foot wall, and at the bottom of the wall is a chunk of concrete. Now, that's what I do for a living. We pour concrete. And there was a reason for me to, the wall was probably 18 inches wide, and I was standing on top cleaning some things off the top of it so we could put some more structures on the top. And instead of going 10 feet over to the ladder, I felt I was feeling kind of lazy and tired that day. So I thought, you know, I'm just going to jump off. And I jumped off and I hit this chunk of concrete. This is my first 2 days back, probably my 2nd day back from having knee surgery. Remember, the final knee surgery, no more. I didn't want to pay for them anymore, and I didn't want to go through the pain and agony anymore. And so I jumped off that wall, and I hit that concrete chunk, and my leg twisted and popped, and I felt everything that the surgeon had done for my knee. I felt it all, that pain, all of a sudden, once more, right in my knee, and I knew in that moment. And I sat on the ground, and I was just so mad at myself, more so than less than pain. I wasn't in pain. I was just angry at myself, and the guys at work were looking at me, like, what's wrong with this guy? And so I told them, I told them to keep it quiet. I couldn't afford to be off of work. But I went home that night in a lot of pain. And I called for the elders of the church, and they came and they laid their hands on my head and they sprayed some specific prayers. One man who's not a doctor, he's in computers, some sort of security thing. But he heard these words come into his head, the bones and the sinew and the marrow, and he just started using terms that he wouldn't normally use. And I thought it was kind of strange coming from this guy, but I felt it. In his hands. And as that night I laid there, I thought, you know, am I better? I was kind of wiggling my knee, trying as I had it elevated and iced. I got up the next day, and it was just fine. The Lord healed me. He had a vision, and I had an experience. And his vision was that he had the vision of my knee, and he saw from the very beginning, or one side, it started on the left side, and he came around the front, and to the other side and around the back side of my knee. And he knew that it was healing from the left side to the right, all the way around to the back side, all the way around. And that is exactly how I felt. The whole knee hurt, but it began to heal, and the pain went away from the left side to the front, to the right side, to the back. I know that the power of God is in the priesthood today. It's not as strong as it should be for whatever reason, but it is in the priesthood today. And whether it's an elder, priest, teacher, or deacon, that there is authority in this church. Okay, I want to get into some other things here. Amos chapter 8. That's Amos chapter 8, verse 11. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will send a famine in the land, and not a famine of bread, nor a thirst of water, but hearing the words of the Lord. And they shall wander from sea to sea, and from the north even to the east, and they shall run to and fro, and seek the word of the Lord, and shall not find it. This was a prophecy. Did this come to pass? Well, there's a date I want you to hear here. 1229 AD, the Catholic Church banned the use of the Bible by anyone but the priests. The membership of the church was not allowed to read the scriptures. Fulfillment of Amos's prophecy, wouldn't you say? 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3 says, let no man deceive you by any means, for there shall come a falling away first, and that man of sin shall be revealed, the son of perdition. This is the part of my sermon that I'm kind of nervous about, because I don't want to rail on anybody in particular. But there's a truth to be had by the world, and that truth needs to be known. A long time ago, in 568, 570 AD, the Lombards invaded Rome and overtook them. That was a culmination of a prophecy given by Daniel in what he termed to be night visions. And not only Daniel, but others. He saw four beasts. And those four beasts had some distinct features. The first was like a lion with eagle's wings. The second was similar to a bear and had three ribs in his mouth. Kind of gory, huh? The third was like a leopard with four wings on its back and had four heads. Daniel was troubled by these visions, these night visions. You can imagine if you saw these and hadn't read them in Daniel first, this would be a terrible thing to have to see. Especially knowing that God's trying to tell you of something that's going to transpire. These were not wonderful looking creatures. These were terrible, scary beasts. After this, I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Among the 10 horns came up another horn with the eyes of a man and a mouth, and it spoke great things. In verse 17, after asking one of the messengers what he saw, Daniel is told, these great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and forever and ever. So he goes through and he has this terrible thing, but he can rest peacefully knowing that in the end, the good will prevail. Now I look at my time and it says I have 8 minutes. I talked to our missionary coordinator on my way to the back. And since the other services took a little longer, I get a little longer. I won't go as long as a 70. I'm just an elder, but I'll give you the information I got. So these 10 horns arise. And what happened was 10 kingdoms overthrew Rome. That happened. Those 10 horns are symbolic of something. And one will arise after them and will be different from the others. And he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws. And they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of times. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it to the end. We know from this text that Daniel knows that the fourth beast will be ugly. And the scripture says he will wear out the saints, wear them out, which means he's going to be mean and cruel, and he will wear them out. They will be so tired and frustrated and just beat down by the time he's done with them. Well, he won't get the chance to be done with them, but by the time the end comes or God puts a stop to it, the saints are going to have had it. We know this is true. I don't want to spend too much time on this. Babylon, Media, Persia, Grecia, and Rome were the four beasts that he saw. But these are actual historical events. There's world history books that talk about these things that transpired. And if you have more time or have an opportunity to listen to somebody, I think Neil Simmons will preach this class, talk about this class every once in a while. I've taught it before, but there are classes. If you're interested, you can do some research yourself or you can find somebody that's teaching them. But there's some really neat stuff. All this does is it points to one true church. Because all of this was prophesied in the Old Testament. And we are given instruction and we're given the ability to see, as we read through the Old Testament, the plan of God unfold. Just briefly, I'd like to mention some things that I found. I read a book called A Marvelous Work and a Wonder by Daniel McGregor. And it's a good read. There's many different books about the apostasy. I'd encourage you to read all of them. Joseph Smith tells us to read all good books. And so I want to encourage you to do the same thing. But in his book, he talks about, he gets pretty specific with the Catholic Church. There's a few things that that are known that were stated in history. One of them was the idea of a pope. When it talks about this man of sin, it goes on in Revelations, and I don't want to read that, but it talks about Revelations chapter 12 and 13 are pretty good for this. But it talks about how the world, they will worship this beast, this great dragon, and all the world will worship to it, and they will wonder at it. But in the years of after 570, after when the Roman Catholic Church came into power, the world wondered after it. There was one world church, and that was the Catholic Church. If you were not Catholic, you were nothing. In fact, there's some historical documents. Well, there's some men, John Wycliffe, who was killed. He believed that men should be able to decide for themselves. They should be able to read the scriptures. They should be able to pray to God and ask forgiveness for their own sins. They should be able to talk to God about their own affairs and not go to somebody and ask them to do it for them. The Catholic Church didn't like this. They had him put to death. They had him burned at the stake. He was dead and gone for a while anyway. His body was buried. There was another man named John Huss. And John Huss came about. He believed the same thing that Wycliffe was teaching. He was kind of one of his disciples or followers. And when he went around teaching and converting people to the truth, that listen, these guys are not, you have the right as a created human being to exercise your own faith and to talk to God yourself, you have that right. He was killed as well, burned at the stake. And in fact, later there was one of the kings dug up his body, John Wycliffe's body, and burnt him. I'm sorry, I said Wycliffe was burnt. He wasn't burnt. He went the way of all old men. He just passed away. Buried him into the earth. They dug up his body and burnt his body just to make sure the point was proven that this will not go on. And the Lord allowed these things to happen because he had to have these prophecies fulfilled. There's some things I'd like that are very important that I believe will culminate all of this apostasy. The scriptures have said that they will wear the saints out. Not only was it John Wycliffe, there was one denomination or faction of people over the course of 30 years, over 100,000 of them were wore out. They were killed, persecuted, either burned at the stake or tortured by some means. We're not the apostles tortured and murdered and treated brutally. How many times was Paul thrown in prison and hit and persecuted? We're not these people wearing out the saints of God. They were. There's a story that I find especially intriguing in the book of Revelation. I think it's interesting that they call it Revelation and not Revelations. But being a father, this kind of speaks to me, knowing a little bit of the pains of carrying a child. But it speaks of a mother who's carrying a child within her. It says this woman was clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head crown of 12 stars. You know, when you read Revelation, nothing you read is just as simple as it sounds. There's a lot of depth to these things. And the woman, as far as we won't get into all that. The woman being with child cried, travailing birth and pain to be delivered. She was ready to have this child. And there appeared another sign in heaven, and there appeared a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns. And I'm sorry, I'm in Revelation chapter 12. And it had 10 horns. It sounds familiar, doesn't it? It had 7 crowns upon its head. Interesting to note that Rome had 7 hills. It had 7 kingdoms or 7 cities. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was delivered, ready to devour her child after it was born. I'd be interested to hear what the rest of the world thinks this means. Because in this church, part of our church is that there was a war in heaven and that a third of the host of heaven was cast out of heaven. And here we see a little bit of that here. It says, his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and did cast them down to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman which was delivered, ready to devour her child after it was born. And so the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared of God that she should feed her, that they should feed her there 1,260 years. Now, if you read Daniel McGregor's book, he really does a good job of laying this out for you, but this idea of 1,260 years is pretty interesting. Revelation 12 uses a time, times, and half a time. It also uses this. It also uses this 1,203 score. Daniel says, and he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of times. There it is again. So we can clearly see in the scriptures are making the claim that the church will flee into the wilderness for 1260 years. Did this actually happen? If so, when? It can be proven that the Lombards invaded Rome, that was the culmination of the invasion by 568 to 572 AD. Now, we're going to go from the middle just because it works out for our process, but if you were to read the book, you'd understand he gives several different measurements of time, prophetic years, lunar years. But each one of these years, when he goes to prophetic years, he can start from five, he draws a year, and it comes out to 1830 as well. But when you add 1260 years where the church is in the wilderness, in darkness, it's being fed, hid from that great beast. When you add that to 570 AD, you come up with 1830. What happened in 1830? A young boy, the story, not in 1830, but prior to, he was convicted. He knew that there was more on the earth than just what had been said before. Remember the reformers, as they spoke their word, as I read those quotes, they knew that there was something greater to be had on the earth, that there was greater power, that we needed to see these ordinances before the church could actually be organized, and they said these things. These are men that the Baptist church and the Methodist church and the Lutheran churches and not the Catholic church, but all these other denominations, they look back to these men and say, these are the founding fathers of our particular church. But yet they even pointed to a restoration of the gospel. So when did that restoration of the gospel transpire? There's no other point in history. No other church makes the claim that we, this church, make. And that boy, when he was wondering, what church do I join? They were all pulling at him from different directions. And he went to his scriptures of all places. What a wonderful place to go when you have a question from God. And the scripture said, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. And so he did that. He went to the Lord and he said, Lord, he retired to the woods. While he was there, he had an experience, and this thick darkness came on him. He couldn't talk, he couldn't see, he couldn't hear, he could think, but he couldn't move. And the only thing he could do was think a prayer, and he asked the Lord to spare him. And instantly the Lord spared him, and he saw the light. And he heard a voice that said, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased, hear him. And he looked up, and Jesus was there. Do not join any of those churches. He was later given instruction by an angel who came and bestowed and told him what to do and where to find the Book of Mormon or the hidden plates. He was shown how to organize the church. He was ordained from on high. No other church makes this claim. These are outlandish claims too. If you're on the outside looking in and it hasn't been a part of you like it has in my life, I was raised in this church. This is something I've been told my whole life. It's not so crazy to me. But look at the evidence in the Old Testament. I've given two scriptures where they were given in the apostasy. There are where the apostasy is foretold. There are tons. There's not tons. There's probably not tons of scriptures in the scriptures. There's many, several scriptures who talk about the dark and cloudy day, or the church going into the wilderness, or being carried away on eagle's wings, or that she will be fed for a time, times, and half a time. And when you go to Ezekiel, you find the King James Version calls it days, not years. But when you go to Ezekiel says that a day is as a year. So even if you only have the King James Bible, you can still glean the same conclusion, that there is one true church and that one day it would be restored. So I want to go back to Isaiah just real quick. Isaiah chapter 29, and this is where I'd like to wrap up. There's a lot of things that have transpired even since this time, since the mid-1800s, that should be a greater testimony to the world or to you that this is the true church. But there are some things that happened, maybe coincidentally, but it's pretty, I don't know, I'm pretty suspicious, I'm pretty interested, or I'm intrigued why they happened at the time period in which they did. See, if you read Isaiah chapter 29, you find these things. Where Lebanon became a fruitful field, I think it was 1856 or 1853. Darwin came out with this wonderful theory that God did not create us. And so when I read this scripture, I know all their works, for shall the work say of him, the work, we are the work, say of him that made it, he made me not. Is this not what the world accepts today or tries to accept? That we're not created by anything? And then the world goes on and buys it. This is the deception of Satan. It's insane. What is more insane? To say that there was a big bang from nothing, which was the claim for years and years, or to say that we were actually created by something? Ask anybody who believes in the Big Bang theory where the matter came from that caused the Big Bang. Now they're finally coming to their senses and saying, well, maybe there was something that created something, but it created the matter that caused an explosion, and then cells over millions and billions of years developed themselves. But their story changes. But one thing doesn't change, and that is the story of the church. God created us. It has stood the test of time from the beginning of time. And it may not have been shown for 1,260 years, but today it is shown. And there is light and truth even yet to come forward from today. One more thing. I don't want to disregard the importance of this book. When I was a young boy, you know, I'm still a young man, I know. When I was a younger man, I rebelled against the teachings of my parents and the teachings of the church. And I decided that I didn't want any part of that church because, well, now that I look at it, my reasoning was it was too much work to be a part to try to do what God wanted you to do. There's too much fun to be had in the world. And I really didn't have any solid evidence that this was true in the first place. And since one of my teammates is here, I'm going to share a story. We played softball together. You were there when I got hit, weren't you? And we were getting killed 42-3. That's no joke. And I was playing catcher, and I decided that I was going to go over to the dugout, and I was going to get the ball. See, they in slow-pitch softball, the batting team supplies the balls. Well, they had hit so many home runs and lost so many, they didn't have any balls left. So they're looking around trying to find a ball, and I'm walking over to their dugout to get a ball from them, and there's some guy taking practice swings in the batter's circle, and he just clubbed me right in the head. Not even paying attention. And you talk about doing knuckleheaded things, that's what I did. I look at that experience today and I say the Lord rung my bell. You know, when I walked off the field that night with my dad in what became known as our team ambulance, because many other people got hurt that year. It was a disaster season. But I walked off and I kicked the grass, and I remember my intention was to grab some dirt and leave a divot in that yard where walking off the field, and I did it. And I told my father, I said, you know, he always told me, if well, God's trying to get a hold of you, he's trying to tell you something. And I said, if he's trying to tell me, why didn't you just tell me? I said, I'm tired of listening, like I was listening before. But something happened to me. One night I had an experience where I got a speeding ticket, and it was one of many. And I'd lost so much money to a family friend who was an attorney to get rid of those points. And I didn't want to afford them anymore, or couldn't afford them anymore. I couldn't afford to face my parents and tell them I got yet another speeding ticket either. And so I got in late that night, and I walked through the house. And my dad, I hadn't told him about it yet, trying to sneak by, and they have this crickety old hallway floor. And I tried to walk by and sneak around the outside so it didn't make any noise. I must have misstepped or something. And he said, Christopher, come in here. And my first thought was great. He's been talking to God, and God told him I got a speeding ticket. And you know, parents have a way of getting the truth out of you without telling you they know what you did. They don't really have a... I don't want to tell my kids my secrets. So I spilled the beans thinking he'd been talking to God, and that if I didn't tell, that he was going to say, listen, I know you're lying because God told me you got a speeding ticket. And so I spilled everything before him. And he, well, I didn't know that. That's what he said to me. But he admonished me to go and pray and talk to the Lord, because if I didn't change my ways, God was going to stop at nothing to get my attention. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. But I went up to my room and I poured my heart out to God and asked God, listen, I'm here. If you want me, come and get me, because I am here, I'm yours. The next morning I woke up and I began to study my scriptures. A few weeks later, I woke up one morning and I just had the desire to do all the things that I wanted to do before was gone, because I had turned my heart over to the Lord. But I went in, I was called to the office of priest, and I shared that testimony at church. And so I told, that was me telling the world, I guess, that I'd changed my life and confessed that I had changed and I was willing to do better and do more and follow God. And so when I did that and that call came, I struggled with that call. And I went up to my room one day and I poured my heart out to God yet again. And I said, listen, I'm willing, I guess, if that's really what you want me to do, but I need a testimony because I don't feel like I can handle that. I don't feel worthy. Well, I'm talking to guys, you find out you're never worthy. We aren't. But I opened the scriptures and I began to read the Book of Mormon and I came to the story of Enos. And as I read Enos and how he went to the woods and he repented of his sins, I began to see myself and feel myself in Enos's shoes. And so I saw myself weeks prior and repenting of my sins and telling the Lord that I am yours. And in that moment, tears came to my eyes because I felt the power of the Lord as I had never felt. Well, that's that I only felt one other time in my life up to that point. And both times when I felt that power of God, it was life-changing. The difference between the first and second one is after the second one, I haven't looked back. I'm not perfect. I'm still an imperfect creature. But I did change my life. This church means something to me. It means something because I look at the evidence in the Old Testament and all the way through the New Testament, and I see the power of God. I see the power of authority, the pattern of the authority. And I read section 83 when it says this. And this should be a testimony to you. All of this should testify of Jesus Christ. I told Jeanette that I would tie this into Bible school. And I want to tie this into Bible school because, first, I want you to recognize that there was Bible school here last week. And that there were, it was said 62, but we had almost 70 kids here one night. That's a lot of kids. Then if you think about the adults who were here, yes, we had an adult class at Vacation Church School, and all are welcome next year to come. But look at what our theme is. Look at these beautiful colors up here. It says what does it say? Tell me what it says. I can't read. I'm on the backside. It says what?
The whole wide world for Jesus.
It's the whole wide world for Jesus. We need to be about promoting the cause of Jesus. We need to tell our testimony of Jesus Christ and what he means to us in our lives. There's a song that I've quoted it 100 times. And it probably, it begins, the artist says, what an unbelieving world simply finds unbelievable is Christians who acknowledge Jesus with their lips but deny him by their lifestyle. We need to be about Jesus, about the cause of Zion, establishing the cause of Zion. But we also need to understand this thing. We need not be afraid of the church to which you belong. Tonight, those of you with parents with children, I want you to ask your children what church they belong to. And think about what they say. If you'd have asked me, I don't know, maybe a child in this generation that's being brought up, you ask them what church do you belong to, they're going to say Devon Park. They're going to say Saints Haven. They're going to say Independence Branch. You're going to say some branch. But what church do we belong to? We belong to Jesus Christ Church, known to us as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This is the church of Jesus Christ. This is his true church. We need to not be ashamed of that fact. You know, it's embarrassing sometimes. They have to stand to somebody and they ask you, what church do you belong to? Somebody told me they put XRLDS if somebody ever asked them on a form. Or maybe just X. I don't know. Sometimes you just get confused. What do I say? Well, you say you're RLDS. Oh, you belong to that community of Christ. And then you got to explain it anyway. Or you got to explain what a restoration branch is. But don't be afraid. You tell them what you are. You belong to Jesus Christ Church. They can say they're Jesus Christ Church, but you belong to Jesus Christ Church, the true church of Jesus Christ. Now, I did bash some other denominations a little bit. And I want to talk a little bit about that, more justify what I've done. But there are all kinds of denominations, and each one of them will trace their roots back somewhere. Each one of them will say, like Lutheran, will trace it back to Martin Luther. I can't remember the guy's name. Benin, I think is his name, is where the Baptist church usually can, most of them will trace their authority back to, or their priesthood, whatever they call it. But you know, if you think about it, did Moses just wake up one morning and say, you know what, I'm the savior of the Israelites? No, he didn't. He woke up one morning and God was there and said, "Hey,